Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report, a lockdown edition. Today's Wednesday, typically the domain of one J.R. Jackson, but because of a little bit of schedule trickery, we got a wild card for you. Emma Vigeland is back.
Hello.
How's it going, Emma?
It's going all right. I think this is the first week I've officially lost it.
Lost it
with quarantine. I'm just like, oh man, I am ready for real life, and it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. I've got this, I have the cabin fever. Like, I want to go out, but I can't really think of anything in particular I want to do. Like, I want to be able to go out and then stay home. Like, I want to choose to be stuck in my man cave. That's what I want.
I would assume, gym rat that you are, you would want to go to the gym, because I want to go to the gym.
That's probably the, if I could do one thing, just because, like, I could work out here. I have dumbbells. I have a backyard.
Right.
I've done it once. That's it. So I am, you know, like, when they go to do a Marvel movie, the actor will undergo like an intensive period of several months of diet and exercise to get in the best shape of their life.
You're doing the reverse.
Exactly the reverse. I don't know what is going to come out of the other end of this quarantine, but it's not going to be positive, and we're going to be cropping my one shots higher and tighter. Anyway, well, I'm very glad to have you here. Should be a lot of fun. Not only because it's a show, and shows are always fun to do with you, but also because it's Earth Day, everybody. And we've got some big stuff planned. Our Earth Day special to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. I've been filming this over the course of the past week and a half or so. I've been talking with any number of different environmental activists and authors and basically everything, reporters. You can tune into that on YouTube and TYT.com at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also watch it on Roku, Pluto TV, Comcast, Xfinity X1, and Flex, Zumo, and YouTube TV at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. And we've got a special going on right now in conjunction with the Earth Day special right now. If you sign up for a free spend and save account at Aspiration, at aspiration.com/TYT, we're going to plant 50 trees, which is awesome. And then once you sign up, every purchase basically that you do will also plant a tree. So just by engaging with the economy, you will be helping to help a little bit with climate change. And importantly, in addition to the Earth Day special, we also have the relaunch of a new cut of my climate change docuseries, True North, that is already airing. The first episode aired on Monday. It's going to be replaying throughout the week on Pluto TV, Roku, all those things I just said. And new one-hour episodes will be airing Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific for the next 5 weeks. And the same episode will air on reruns throughout the week. So you can watch the first episode all this week, and then follow it over the course of the next month or so. It was my trip with investigative reporter and documentarian Shivala Madlina in the Arctic, basically, in Svalbard, on a sealing vessel with climate change scientists. It was a lot of fun, and so it's now available to be seen for the first time in a couple of years.
So cool, John.
It was cool. I'm excited. I want to go back and find some of the photos that I took and post them as like a throwback for Earth Day.
Basically, go crazy.
It should be fun. Okay. So to those of you who are already here, we got a lot that we're going to be talking about. We're going to launch into it in just a minute. If you haven't already, please hit the like button and share the stream so as many people as possible can know that we're doing this show. And with that, why don't we jump into the news, Emma? Donald Trump came out strong against short-sighted governors who are reopening their economies, shutting down the quarantines prematurely with his tweet, "All the governors are already backing off of the Ebola quarantines. Bad decision that will lead to more mayhem." Wait, hold on. Wait, Ebola? Ebola?
What?
Oh, that was in 2014. Oh, it was another crisis. And we were very worried at the time. I don't know if you recall, but we were very worried about the spread of Ebola. And when these governors decided to open up, doing what they were doing, it was potentially a risk, but slightly less of one, because only two people ever died of Ebola in the United States. Both of them had contracted it abroad. Literally no one who got sick in America from Ebola, and there were virtually no people who did. None of them actually died. So, little bit different situation, slightly different calculus now, very different position from the president.
Very different, and, you know, you can't hypocrisy shame the shameless, but we can try. And, We do with Trump. I mean, there really is a tweet for everything. And what's crazy is with this encouragement for the governors to basically reopen their states, it's in violation of the very guidelines that the Trump administration has set out, where you're supposed to have a downward trajectory of cases for, I believe, 4 weeks, and no one has hit that target yet. And yet they're all going to start reopening. Brian Kemp, who literally learned the most basic facts about coronavirus maybe 2 days ago, is about to reopen his state and Texas, among many others. So brace yourselves, because we're going to hit a second, third wave throughout this year.
Yeah, and look, as we reported this yesterday, and as I laid out, basically everything's going to reopen in 2 days. Some things wait until Monday. Ooh, very strong. Except that people who are more likely to die from coronavirus are being told to wait 3 weeks before going out. And as I laid out yesterday, that's great because that means that we then have 2 to 3 weeks of everyone else going out, catching coronavirus, spreading it to each other, and then only once the maximum number of people have it, we will reintroduce the immunocompromised into the public. Great idea. Definitely won't kill tons of people. But anyway, yeah, and to your point that there's a tweet for everything, how did he say, like, it's so specific every time? I guess this is the issue with tweeting constantly, everything that pops into your head.
And I don't even really, well, I'm guilty of tweeting constantly, but I don't even understand. I don't remember, to be honest with you, that there were stay at home or quarantine, keep at home orders for Ebola. I mean, obviously not at this scale, but that's how
No,
specific
no.
it has to be. I don't even remember.
So basically, there were limited quarantines of people who just recently traveled. Like, it was that specific. It was like nurses coming back from treating Ebola were being quarantined, and just a few people, basically.
Yes, I remember now, and that is why that is unbelievable, because that is so extremely
It
specific.
would be like if he tweeted this morning, "Look at President Obama. He's recklessly threatening to shoot down Iranian gunboats. And by the way, it's not down, they're not up." It would be that specific. We can expect now. Anyway, but look, we're laughing because we're losing our minds gradually, thanks to the quarantine. But this is serious, and they're reopening very soon. And we just were saw revealed, thanks to publicintegrity.org, the Center for Public Integrity, they got access to government documents that have been updated very recently about how many people would die if these stay-at-home orders were lifted prematurely. And it turns out it's a lot. So let's delve into that. So first, you should know that while the White House Coronavirus Task Force has cited other models created at academic institutions, the federal government hadn't made public its own modeling efforts. But thanks to NPR and the Center for Public Integrity, we do have some of those estimates now. In the documents, the best guess for how things will play out without further mitigation says that coronavirus cases and deaths would double about every 5.5 days. On average, one coronavirus-infected person would spread the virus to another 2.5 people, and that 0.5% of infected people who show symptoms would die. 4 of 7 experts that they consulted said certain assumptions in the documents, such as how deadly the virus is, are too rosy. And by the way, the documents don't spell out how many deaths this new higher fatality rate, because by the way, the too rosy estimates that those experts are talking about, that's after the new model doubled the death rate. That is still considered too rosy. But taking that new estimate, Public Integrity has estimated that about 600,000 people hypothetically could die as a result of prematurely lifting these quarantines, which is just horrific. And it puts us right up again with some of the scariest estimates from before the quarantine orders.
Yeah, and I was seeing Fox News panelists, well, actually it was Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on Tucker Carlson's show, talking about how, yeah, first Fauci said it would be millions. Now he's said 10,000. Now he's saying 200,000. I'm like, okay, those aren't real figures. But also the number shifted based on new data, new ways of behavior. All these data points, it's all fluid. And so acting as if our actions don't directly affect those numbers and the consequences of those numbers is purposely misleading, but, you know, all these Republicans know that. They're just thirsty for their portfolios to look similar to how they did before this pandemic, you know, was such a scourge in the entire world.
Exactly. Exactly. And so how many people died in individual states? Let's break this down. I had this graphic pulled, but I realize now there's no way you're going to be able to tell what that is. That's my bad call. But I will sum it up for you.
Yellow is not helpful.
But conveniently, it does look like some sort of blade being wielded against the American people. So I'm seeing that California will lose 200,000 people or so. Let's see, Florida will lose 140,000. You got Pennsylvania at about 80. And you really have to give it to Trump and these Republican governors, because going into a presidential election, killing hundreds of thousands of people in the most important swing states that they'll be facing, that is a bold strategy, but one that they are pursuing, because they think, I think, two things. One, they think that fake illusory gains in the economy, which doesn't affect any of the 90% of Americans who don't have a significant number of stocks, are more important. And they think that they, in conjunction with Fox News, will be able to bamboozle their fans into not realizing that these deaths could have been prevented. They've been working overtime at that. That's just about the only thing Fox has done for the past month is do damage control, as every day, you know, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 more Americans die because of the incompetence of the Trump administration.
And I think that there's actually, unfortunately, a lane for that propaganda to work. Because coronavirus is so unprecedented in a global pandemic like this, and the economic downturn and the lives lost, it's so different than what people have actually experienced, and there's no way for them to have a blueprint for it. People are able to kind of brush it off and say, oh, what could he have done? What could he have done? How could you have contained this? Actually, he could have done a variety of different things that he very pointedly refused to do, most notably in February when he was still holding rallies. He did a travel ban, thought it would be fine, didn't prepare anyone or any hospitals, didn't stock up on ventilators, didn't ensure that our public health care system was at least a modicum more prepared. He could have done so many things, but it's so unprecedented and so removed from the consciousness is conscious. I can never say the plural of the American people that it's almost easy to get away with that propaganda, as opposed to, say, if he started another illegal war, which he might be trying to do with goading Iran this morning on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And even if we took that, the version of the Trump fan thing that you were saying, that what could he have done? Okay, let's say that he couldn't have done anything. Totally could have, but let's say that he couldn't have. There was nothing that could have been done. Today, he's telling people to protest in the streets to prematurely take down the court. Like, we should and we will criticize all of the missteps along the way, but we're having to update that every single day, because every day he makes it worse. And he is not just singularly making it worse, but he is putting pressure on Republican politicians to do exactly the wrong thing. Exactly the thing that will lead to the most people dying. That's not a month ago. It's not January 15th. That's today. His press conference today will advocate for a course of action that we are showing you that the Department of Health and Human Services says will kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. They will advocate for that literally today.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
As we talk about those who are advocating for these quarantine orders to be lifted prematurely, we often use the language of sacrifice, that those in the media, the Republican politicians, are willing to sacrifice people, including their own voters, for one of several different benefits, either the perceived improvement of their approval numbers, maybe a slightly higher chance that Trump will get reelected, or for short-term economic gains for themselves in terms of their stock portfolios. And I want to see more politicians, more Democrats, being willing to call it like it is. And we do have one. So Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted earlier, GOP is seriously arguing that it's worth sacrificing the lives of hourly workers so they can get a spray tan again, referencing Brian Kemp allowing tanning parlors to open up in just a few days. She says, if they really wanted to reopen the economy, they'd fund mass testing, contact tracing, and healthcare for people. Instead, they're fighting against hospital funding. And that is 100% right. If the priority really was, we have to open things up, then at the very least, you could take the advice of medical experts who say, we have to have testing kits everywhere, we have to do contact tracing, we have to do everything possible to make sure that it doesn't start to spread again. But they won't do that. They want to have their cake and then infect you like with quarantine with a coronavirus too.
Yeah, I mean, as usual, she nails it. And what blows my mind really is the Senate bill that was agreed to, the small business relief package that was agreed to yesterday, that AOC is against when it comes to the House. The Democrats, Chuck Schumer, leader of the Democrats in the Senate, was acting as if securing some sort of testing and hospital funding was a huge concession on the part of the Republicans. They were fighting against it.
Yeah.
But then they did get some hospital funding and some funding for testing in the bill. But it was a concession for the Republicans, who just wanted basically more money to go to small businesses, corporations that have been abusing this fund to take out loans and get cash flow quickly. So, the fact that the Republicans don't want to give medical funding, don't want to ensure that the hospitals have what they need to adequately combat this disease should be counterintuitive if the party was operating in good faith. When really what they're about is just enriching sectors and their donors and themselves with this quick amount of cash flow liquidity that's going to be coming from our tax dollars.
I 100% agree. I can't believe with all of the obvious misinformation, lack of care for the number of lives that have been lost, the Democratic response has been, for the most part, just silence or just going along. Like, they... If there, we shouldn't have to look.
Or Pelosi going on late night TV and showing off her incredibly lavish kitchen. That there's just no understanding, exactly. And they're allowing the Republicans to frame while the Republicans are enriching their donors and their businesses, allowing the Republicans to frame themselves as the more populous ones because Schumer and Pelosi are like, how about some more Cobra grants and funding and that, you know it.
You have to provide an alternative, and they really won't. They're just letting it happen. Like 45,000 people have died that we know of. I'll acknowledge that, but 45,000 people have died. The vast majority of them didn't need to, and the Democratic response in large part is, well, I mean, we don't want to be impolite.
And part of why the Republicans can get away with it is because Black Americans, low income people, are disproportionately affected by this. And so, one, Republicans don't care, and two, Democrats don't care as much as they should. I mean, the Democrats should be talking about how these are workers on the front lines, the Whole Foods cashier who's, you know, checking out your acai. Yeah, they're disproportionately affected and could die from coronavirus.
Yeah.
And those are the people that we should be protecting with our government, not Shake Shack.
Exactly. And the ice cream thing, like the right. is, like, they always talk about how they're against the elites and all of that, and they say that the Democrats are for them when they, you know, obviously, blah, 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 all the stuff about Trump. Gold plated toilet, you fill in all of that. They've got, like, people, like, on the Fox and Friends host who's talking about how au pairs need to be protected because that's the only problem with the immigration changes, that our servants will be messed with. And then she goes on and says today, so Trump has reassured us that those sorts of servants for middle-class families will actually not be affected by this. First of all, no middle-class family has a goddamn butler. They are teeing it up that they are the ones who are elitist, out of touch, and willing to take the entire working class and feed it through a meat grinder so that the NASDAQ can go up by 10% for the next week so they can recover a little bit of the money they lost before selling it off again. And the Democrats are just making it kind of a wash. And really fast, there's just one other thing I want to show about this. In terms of the being willing to sacrifice so many to reopen the economy to benefit the most wealthy people in the country. And in reference to the fact that I've been calling them just an out-and-out death cult at this point, take a look at this graphic. This is from, I think it's local news, at one of these protests. A guy has a sign that says, "Sacrifice the weak, reopen now." And I understand it's just one person, and it's one sign. But they are becoming more comfortable with just openly saying, yeah, sacrifice not me, not allow myself to make the choice. Sacrifice the weak. Sacrifice them so that I can benefit right now. And that guy probably won't even benefit. He's likely to get coronavirus and die. But wealthy politicians that he supports, they will benefit in the short term, at least.
It's not the weak. People are being affected in this way. That's, you know, it's, you can't tell how someone's going to be affected by this, how they're going to respond. You know, there was a kid in New Jersey, just, you know, a town away, a few towns away from where I grew up, who was in a medically induced coma for weeks. He just got out, but he could have died. He was 25 years old, lacrosse player, like athlete. We don't know how this is going to affect everyone. And yeah, of course, the pro-life people want to sacrifice the weak for the economy to reopen. This is really unmasking themselves here.
The VA has released the results of one of their early studies in terms of how hydroxychloroquine, as well as other medicines that are being considered as a possible solution to coronavirus, might affect survival rates. And this is important because there is literally no medicine in the world that we have heard more about over the last 6 weeks than hydroxychloroquine, thanks to its incredible amount of boosting early on from Tucker Carlson. John Oliver did a great job in tracking the evolution of the hydroxychloroquine conversation. And unfortunately for those who were saying it was a miracle cure, it was going to produce Lazarus-like effects, it had a 100% effectiveness rating, that is not what they found. About 28% who were given hydroxychloroquine plus the usual care died versus 11% of those getting routine care alone. About 22% of those getting the drug plus azithromycin died too, but the difference between that group and the usual care was not considered large enough to rule out other factors that could have affected survival. Hydroxychloroquine also made no difference in the need for a breathing machine either. So we've got some other results, but that's like the immediate headline version. It did not save 100% of all people. In fact, more people died when they were given it than others, which really should not be that surprising, considering it is a dangerous medicine with serious, indeed potentially fatal, side effects.
Well, I'm not hearing this on Fox News. They were constantly pushing it. I'm not hearing this from Donald Trump. I would love if he gets up on the podium today at one of his, you know, adrenaline junkie spats with the press where he gets his fix because he can't go to his campaign rallies. I'd love if he walked some of these statements back and talked about how maybe it was a little bit reckless for him to be pushing this against the medical advice of Dr. Fauci on stage over and over again, causing a run on this drug, prescriptions mishandled, given to the wrong people, lupus patients unable to access their medication, because this is a significantly dangerous drug. And that's why we have trials. That's why the medical professionals should be allowed to do what they do. But when you have an ego the size of Donald Trump and a propaganda machine like Fox News that follows suit,
yeah.
You're going to throw caution to the wind.
Yeah, and so we're going to get a little bit of the reaction from them to this. But I really, fast, I want to let you know a little bit more about what they got from the study. They found that they didn't track side effects, but they noted hints that hydroxychloroquine might have damaged other organs. And the drug has long been known to have potentially serious side effects, including altering the heartbeat in a way that could lead to sudden death. Now, if you've been watching the show for a long time, you already knew all of this stuff. It's not surprising to find out that it could lead to more people dying. It is dangerous. We've been talking about that for some time in response to the fact-free, you know, snake oil boosting that it's gotten from places like Fox News and otherwise. And we have to say at this point that this is one study. More studies are being done right now. The results could come out any day and could potentially change our evaluation of this. But I would say it doesn't look like it. There was reason to believe that this is the way it would go. And there was hope that hypothetically it could be particularly effective against coronavirus. But there was never a good reason. There was only one kind of sham study that was being boosted by Fox News early on, being boosted by a guy that had no affiliation with the university he was being promoted as being from. I've heard no apology from them on that. And so, look, it would have been great if there was a miracle drug that dealt with this. Everybody wants that. But what everybody doesn't want and doesn't need is false hope that's being spread by people who are trying to distract you from the ongoing failures of an administration that isn't taking this virus seriously enough.
I was just going to say, perhaps people should be a little bit cautious about taking science advice from a party that does not believe in climate change. They've always been aggressively anti-science, and now they know everything about science and hydroxychloroquine. Not so much.
Exactly. Like the idea that they care about doctors. If they cared about doctors, they'd bring on real doctors, not TV doctors or those who call themselves doctors but are not doctors. That would be a great start. But as we've been saying, Fox News has boosted hydroxychloroquine a ton. There's been great work in documenting their early comments about it. You can see Media Matters had tracked 300 times in just a 2-week period that Fox News had been boosting hydroxychloroquine. And look, you might think, well, you know, there was a chance that it could end up being a significant cure. So shouldn't they discuss this? The issue with that is that they didn't present it as a possible cure. They presented it as a solution to all of our problems. And you can see that with the breakdown, with claims promoting that you should use it versus those who are casting doubt or saying that we should be, you know, waiting for to find out from studies how effective it is. It was a 10-to-1 margin, just you should take this, it'll cure you, to this is a possible solution that might help, but we need to wait to find out. They didn't want to wait. They wanted to either profit individually, because if you believe that these hosts, like Tucker Carlson, the guy who really started this, if you believe that he didn't invest in these companies beforehand, I would be shocked to find that out. And even if he didn't, we know that members of the Trump administration did before they used their daily press briefings to promote this drug and the companies that make it over and over and over again. And while in those early weeks they were talking about it hundreds of times, literally every week, how much have you heard from them in the past day? Since this VA study came out, have there been big apologies? I got too excited. I should have been more cautious. I'm not hearing that. I don't expect to.
Of course. And, you know, so I've been quarantining with my family, and someone in my family, you know, works in finance. And so there's CNBC on TV all the time. And I see how basically the anchors, the guests they have on, are pushing all of these miracle drugs. Oh, the stock's going up for this company that might be finding a cure. Oh, this, you know, little medical shop in Florida, whatever, they're looking to find a cure. They may race to find it. And you just see the profit incentive behind it. And that's part of what leads people like Trump and Republicans and Fox News hosts to kind of rush to judgment. And we're going to see this again. It's not going to be the last drug that people think is a miracle all cure for this. But the reality is that we have to be patient, something that Republicans are completely unfamiliar with.
Yeah. And if we're going to have to be patient, then we should do what is necessary until we get a vaccine to make sure that as few people die as possible. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to distract you with miracle cures and then do nothing to actually get to hospitals what we know we need, which is testing kits, PPE, ventilators, all of that. And by the way, I'm going to play for you in just a sec Trump being asked about this study, because you can bet your ass he was not going to bring it up if he wasn't asked. But the difference between, like, the more obviously fringe conspiracy theory right media and Fox News is getting more sort of just, it's like a philosophical thing. Because immediately after coronavirus was being considered seriously, what did people like Alex Jones do? So they hawked, like, toothpaste that had silver in it or something like that as a solution to all of this. Okay, he had toothpaste with silver. Fox News had hydroxychloroquine. At the end of the day, I think that Alex Jones is the better person because that toothpaste with silver probably isn't going to stop your heart at the very least. And if you buy up the country's stock of silverish toothpaste, at least people with lupus aren't going to go without medicine that they need. So at the end of the day, it is possible that for the same reason, financial gain, Fox News promoted a drug that would lead to more deaths than the craziest conspiracy theorists in the country right now.
Yeah, it's just conspiracy theorists, except they say it in a more glossy, more socially acceptable manner. But the reality is that it's not too different.
Well, I think you wanted to follow up on the hydroxychloroquine.
The hydroxychloroquine, I'm wondering if you're concerned, this VA study showed that actually more people died that used the drug that didn't, and I'm wondering if Governor Cuomo brought you back any results.
No, we didn't discuss it, and I don't know of the report. Obviously, there have been some very good reports, and perhaps this one's not a good report, but we'll be looking at it. We'll have a comment on it.
A panel of experts at the NIH is actually now recommending against the use of hydroxychloroquine in combination with ZPAC, which is something you've been recommending.
I'm always willing to take a look.
And,
Damn it, because he just brushed by that.
He didn't want to talk about it. No.
Well, maybe I'll do it after this we finish here. I'm going to mash up his discussions about how hydroxychloroquine and his continued promotion of it with that clip. That would be fascinating.
That would be fascinating, but I want to preempt you. So remember when he said, "What really do we have to lose? The drug doesn't kill people." That was less an impression of Donald Trump and more an impression of Stephen Colbert doing an impression of Donald Trump. But
yeah, it was very breathy. Very breathy.
Everybody calm down. It'll go away. It'll go away. That's what he does. It's the creepiest thing he does.
Don't do that again.
Maybe one more time.
Okay.
No, so what really do we have to lose? It doesn't kill people. Well, you have nothing to lose, but people potentially have their lives to lose. And we knew already at the time that it can kill people. We knew that then. We just have more evidence of it now. There's no point in pointing out how, like, they say that Trump is an alpha male, that he's masculine, that he's strong. But it's so predictable. Anytime he's proven to be wrong, and there's evidence of it, you point it out to him, he will always say what he said in that video. Which is, I didn't see it. No, I'm not familiar with that study. You know, I've only been talking about hydroxychloroquine every chance I get for 2 months. Big study comes out done by the VA, which I say I care about. I didn't see it. Like when pictures will show him with someone who's involved in his, you know, impeachment. I didn't see the picture. I don't know about the picture. Think about that. You think that this person is an alpha strong male? They just lie about not, they use ignorance to say that, you know, they can't be pinned down on this. Like, what a weak thing to do. Wouldn't an actual strong alpha male own up to it and say, you know what, I went to bat for this thing and I thought we had a real chance, and unfortunately, it looks like it's not going to turn out to be the miracle cure that I was hoping, but you know what, we're going to keep looking and we're going to find something that's going to save lives. At least do that. That would be sort of stupid. That'd be sort of dishonest. But it wouldn't be so obviously cowardly to just say, I'm not familiar with it. The reporter right there, he summed up what the study said. You don't even need to have seen it, and you definitely did see it, you lying coward.
Yeah, I mean, but it all comes back to this, John. Like, it's about projecting strength. Arrogance is too often mixed up with strength in this country, and he's like a complete case study in that.
Today is Earth Day, a particularly important one, the 50th anniversary. And It is a reminder to us that the Earth matters, the environment matters, our climate matters, and we should still be thinking about it even though we are in the middle of this terrible crisis. And we should also be thinking about the interaction of the crisis we're already in terms of our environment, in terms of our climate, and the current one with this pandemic, because there is a very strong link there. A new nationwide study conducted by Harvard showed that just a single microgram per cubic meter increase in the common air pollutant PM2.5 can increase the death rate from COVID-19 by 15%. And a study published in Environmental Pollution this month examined the high death rates in northern Italy, one of Europe's most polluted areas, concluding that air pollution should be considered another factor in COVID-19 fatality. So obviously there are a lot of things that influence how likely you are to die, but the pollution that we have been just like wantonly pumping into the atmosphere, that is making certain populations far more likely to die. And we're seeing the effects of that in terms of the racial disparity in America as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. I was thinking that as well. And just the fact that it's so confounding, it's confounding variables, or compounding, I should say, when you're in urban areas where, yeah, people who are Black are disproportionately affected by the coronavirus. Then on top of it, they're densely populated. And on top of that, it's more polluted. So that's part of the reason that it's affecting New York, other cities more intensely, because it turns out pollution, which is bad for you, is also bad when it's mixed with the coronavirus, makes it a lots of bad there.
Exactly. And like this new information about the coronavirus, so we can add that in effectively to the death toll every year from air pollution, but it's not like that death toll wasn't already horrendous and not nearly reported at the level it should be. The World Health Institute estimates that air pollution kills more than 7 million people annually. Low and middle income countries are most affected by this pollution, which has been linked to aggressive behavior, attention deficit disorder, heart disease, lung cancer, and more. That's not the combination. That's just the situation we were already in. And it doesn't get talked about. Like if literally anything else killed 7 million people that wasn't heart disease, diabetes, cancer, those sorts of things that we know are massive killers, it would be a conversation every day. But when it comes to air pollution, we talked about it more in the early 90s than we do today. And it's still a massive problem. And I want to make sure that, especially as we're talking about climate change, like, you need to make sure that the things that will solve climate change, the issues of climate change, are related to a number of other issues, including pollution. That is not, pollution and deforestation are not things that we cured back when you were a kid. They are still a massive problem, in fact, increasing, both of those. New York is apparently considering dispensing with this whole remnants of democracy thing by stripping Bernie Sanders away from the ballot. So that if you are a voter who's been looking forward to your ability to register your support for Bernie Sanders, you might not get that chance. Board of Elections co-chair Douglas Kellner and Commissioner Andrew Spano, both Democrats, will meet Wednesday to decide on whether or not to remove Sanders' name from the ballot. Kellner believes that a provision in the 2019-2020 budget saying the board may remove a candidate from the ballot if they make clear they are no longer seeking the office in question requires Sanders' removal. And a quote from Kellner says, "It's not very controversial that Bernie Sanders has suspended his campaign. I anticipate that we will be removing him." Thoughts, Emma?
Well, I really want to vote for Bernie Sanders. I live in New York City. Not now, but I have been. And I want to be able to vote for him. My friends, my boyfriend, we all want to be able to cast our votes for Bernie Sanders because we want him to have the staying power and the capital to actually get concessions from the Biden campaign. But this is par for the course with the New York City Board of Elections and the amount of hoops that they try to get people to jump through to basically have any progressive agenda that comes through. Like I talked about this actually with then candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she was having a really hard time getting on the ballot. The threshold was huge for her. Her district was drawn weirdly. There was a huge effort on behalf of the Democratic Party machine to kind of suppress insurgent candidates who were going up against the incumbents. And so they've always been this way in New York. There's a huge political machine behind New York City politics, and it's democratic, it's blue, yes, but it's institutionalized and very anti-progressive. And so that's part of what we're seeing here. If he's suspended his campaign, who cares if he's on the ballot? What's the point? Why can't Bernie Sanders be someone who everyone's, you know, going to be voting for, at least expressing their adoration and love for all of the policies that he pushed forward? Why would that be so threatening to you? Mm-hmm. And that's because maybe they're afraid that Biden's not going to generate that kind of enthusiasm, and it's going to look pretty bad when Bernie Sanders comes out on top.
Yeah, or at the very least, they know that Bernie Sanders would like to go into the convention with as much clout as possible to influence the direction that Biden's going to go in, and they don't want him to do that. And if that means that they get to tell, you know, hundreds of thousands of voters at the very least, no, you don't need to participate, you're done, you don't get to register your support for this guy, then they're willing to do that. Even though, understand that this is all happening during a conversation about what can Joe Biden and the centrists do to get the support of progressives. I think they might be moving in the wrong direction, telling them to go F themselves right now. Many people are perfectly satisfied to eventually support Joe Biden if he's running against Donald Trump. But why are you going to needlessly give the middle finger to them now? They have been working for Bernie Sanders, supporting Bernie Sanders, donating to Bernie Sanders, rallying and organizing around Bernie Sanders. Let them vote for him. Many of them would then go on to support Joe Biden. But perhaps now a smaller number, a lower percentage will do that after they've been reminded once again of how little respect that the establishment Dems have for them, particularly in New York, which when I read about like machine politics from back, decades and decades ago, a lot of that is history, but not really. Some of it is still alive in New York. It is the most messed up system that is still allowed to exist in the Democratic Party.
And presided over by Andrew Cuomo, it's very important for him to maintain that system. We saw, you know, the IDC, they've been disbanded, but that was a huge part of why Albany was so corrupt and remains fairly corrupt, although there have been some good progressives like Julia Salazar who have broken through. But no, New York City is still, and New York State, in fact, is still one of the most corrupt political machines in the entire nation. And it's run by Democrats. It's fully blue. And, you know, that doesn't really help Democrats' arguments when they want to counter Trump's swamp narrative when state politics in New York is so swampy in itself.
It's been clear for some time now that not every group is being affected by coronavirus in the same way or at the same rates. We've talked about things like the effect of higher concentrations of pollution in some urban areas, leading to a greater number of deaths in those areas. But there are some differences that appear to be driven by human behavior, by the advocacy of some members of the media and in politics. And joining us now to discuss is professor and director of Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University and author Jonathan Metzl. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much. Great to be back.
Very glad to have you on. I feel like this conversation is similar in many ways to the conversation we had the last time you were on about, you know, the effect that the advocacy of certain types of elites, the way that they attempt to use their power and persuasion, can lead to potentially a greater number of deaths in some areas. And so are we seeing that so far in coronavirus?
We're unfortunately seeing it almost on steroids right now. I mean, the frustrating part for me is that, for example, all of these protests that are against the public health measures that are saving people's lives are really being fueled by wealthy corporations and donors. And Washington Post had a great article about that today. And in a way, the frustrating part is that these aren't even views that are shared by a majority of people in red states. So these ideas that people need to get out and protest against public health measures that are saving their lives, really, it's a form of kind of manipulation in a way. And they're using a lot of the same triggers that I studied in my book, Dying of Whiteness, which is playing to people's fears of government intrusion or the idea that, you know, immigrants or minorities are behaving badly or that this is just a particular illness that just affects minorities. Mm-hmm. So in a way, a lot of the same themes that I saw in my research are now being used to manipulate people, honestly, to to these really, really terrifying rallies. And I'm quite frightened for what's going to happen after this.
Yeah, it really does seem like this is a combination of so many different elements of the movement, that you have some people who are talked to at these protests who seem to believe that for religious reasons they will be immune to the coronavirus. Some are coming out to protect their Second Amendment rights that they have been convinced are under assault. Some seem to just be indicating solidarity with the Republican Party or with Donald Trump. It seems like different people are being driven for different reasons to participate in this. And I'm curious, based on your prior research, does this open up any opportunities perhaps for reasonable people to break through? Like, is there any way that we can communicate with these people to try to, like, not to put too fine a point on it, to save their lives?
Well, I think it's very important to note. I mean, right now, many of us are stuck at home. We're getting all of our information, which is in a way, a lifeline, but, from our computers. And so I think it's important to note. I've been doing research over the course of this pandemic, and I've seen a lot of public opinion polls also, that many Republicans and in red states are also very afraid of the coronavirus. Many of them are not ready to run out to their next tattoo parlor or movie theater and just start getting back to life because they know that this is a deadly illness. And so in that regard, I think that there is the moment right now for a kind of coming together to save people's lives. But I think part of the issue is that there's so much power in the kind of bullhorn that President Trump has right now. And every time his messages are things like, your Second Amendment rights are under attack, which is something he tweeted about liberating the states, or this idea that this is, big government coming in. It spurs a certain minority of people to go out. And in a way, what that looks like is that those people represent all people in red states. And that's not the case. But I think there is an opportunity. The question is really just going to be how can we reach people and how can we talk to them? Because I do think there is a chance to find some common ground right now.
You know, it's interesting because I know that in the past you've talked about, for instance, the way that the Republican Party will push an economic agenda that will be supported by its base, even though it, demonstrably is harming them. And you can see that in other areas as well. It seems like in this case, they're pushing for an approach to this disease that will, in the end, kill many, many people. A lot of them, probably a disproportionate number, will be their own voters, their own supporters. In the past, in the economic area, they don't seem to really be hurt by the fact that they time and time again hurt their own voters with their policies. Do you think that this might be different, that there might be an electoral cost that they will have to pay if what they're advocating for right now leads to potentially tens or hundreds of thousands of additional casualties, many of which might be their own people?
Well, the narrative scripts are so powerful that they're calling on this idea of kind of anti-government message, this idea of anti-immigrant, pro-Second Amendment message. And in a way, it's very hard if they're cornering the market on that narrative. It's very hard honestly to get airspace for any other kind of narrative. I know in Tennessee where I live, I have many friends who are libertarian, who are Republican, who are gun owners, who are appalled by what's happening, not just about people protesting against the stay-at-home orders, but also, people with no history of any gun training or gun ownership rushing out to buy a bunch of guns and having them in their homes when their kids are being homeschooled, don't know about, not knowing about safe storage practices. So there's, people in red states who are pushing for Medicaid expansion, which would dramatically help the economic outlook as well as the medical outlook. So I think there are people who are disaffected, but right now, the airspace is so taken up by these scripts, these kind of anti-government, anti-immigrant, I'm going to defend your gun rights kind of scripts, that I think it's incumbent on people to think about other ways to make connections that might create other avenues for conversation. So, I think the other point to remember about this is that in this virus, we're all equally vulnerable. Like, creating networks is in all of our interest. And one thing to think about, for example, is what would red states look like right now if people in New York and Los Angeles hadn't taken this very seriously and hadn't done their own stay-at-home orders? Red states would be devastated right now, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation. So the only reason red states are having this conversation is because of the responsible ways that many people on the coast acted. And so I think that there are so many examples right now of the importance that we're all connected. But again, I think that message is being co-opted by some very powerful interests. And so it's really incumbent on us to think about what are other ways that we can reach across the divide right now.
I think that is a great point. And I'm glad that you made the point about effectively the cities locking down so early on has helped to limit, even though many of the people living in those other states that have been relatively spared by this have been incredibly critical of places like, you know, California and New York. You bring up a great point there. One other area of your research that I think seems very important to talk about right now is the use of racial resentment to help to manipulate these people. And we've seen, you referenced, you know, the belief that this is a disease that only affects non-white people. That certainly is out there. There have been early and persistent attempts to brand this as the Chinese virus or the China virus. And we've seen a rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans or Asians in America. What do you think about this as a strategy? Will they continue to do this? Will it be effective to try to tie race so closely to this virus?
It's race, but it's also othering. In other words, with this virus, everybody wants to feel like, oh, I'm not at risk because it's somebody else's fault, or what's happening right now is somebody else's fault. And so I would just say, first, as a kind of empathic, I'm not trying to in any way excuse racism, but I would just say, as a natural human response at this moment, we all want to feel like what's happening to us isn't the result of our own vulnerability in a particular way. So I think people right now, they're afraid, they're terrified, they're looking for some answer to something that makes absolutely no sense. And that's why I think it's irresponsible at any time of leadership to convey messages like that, but especially in a time like this, where again, the need for us to come together is so powerful, to play into scripts of race and racism, you know, blaming not just China, but, you know, all this Asian American sentiment that's happening now that's terrible, tons of racism. In a way, it plays to people's fear, it plays to people's tribalism, and it's a reflection of irresponsible leadership in a way. I think that really what we need to be doing is to be combating, you know, tribalism and racism are as dangerous for us right now as the virus, because when we isolate in tribes, we can't kind of marshal a coordinated response to the virus in a way. And so in a way, responsible leadership would basically be saying nobody is safe until everybody is safe, which is really biologically true right now with this virus. So to say, you know, we're going to limit these people, or we're going to, you know, it's those guys over there, in a way, it's just going to, it's obviously hugely problematic from a moral and ethical standpoint, but it's also making our country, you know, much more at risk to the virus itself.
Yeah. You know, I think you raise a great point that we want to believe that for X reason or Y reason, we're not going to be affected in the same way. It might be a class thing or a race thing or a religious thing or I believe there's a miracle cure, so I don't have to worry about a thing. But one thing that I'm curious about is I would have guessed, if you'd asked me at the very beginning of this, that there would be a certain number of deaths that would be, you wouldn't be able to convince people that this wasn't a serious problem. And I would have guessed and been wrong early on that at 45,000 American deaths, there'd be no way to not acknowledge that this is an absolute disaster. But clearly I was wrong about that. They can do that. They're doing that every day. Is there a number where you think they won't be able to deny it if this hits 90 or 200 or 500,000? Will then some of this manipulation be less effective?
I mean, you know, in every life lost to this tragedy is itself a tragedy. You know, yes. My family, my father lost his best friend this morning. You know, it's a moment where
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Death is just indiscriminate right now. But I would also say that we you know, the number of deaths at this point, I mean, we're going to see a lot more, but right now the number of deaths to coronavirus in this country reported are the same number of deaths that we see in gun violence in this country, roughly. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you would think that it's like, couldn't we all come together as humans to present this kind of tragedy? But what we saw is the more desperate people get, the more polarized they get. The more these kind of scripts that we're talking about become much, much more intense in a way. And so I think the danger of this is not, hopefully, again, people will be able to come together. But I would say that I've just seen in my research that with gun research, the more tragedy there was, the more ideological people became, the more fractured they became, the harder it became to form common sense solutions. Mm. And so I think there's no number at which we're all going to kind of come together at the middle. It's the work is still the same. The work of trying to build divides, the work of trying to talk to people who might not agree with us, but that that really we need them for our safety and they need us for their safety. So I don't think there is some kind of magic number here. And in fact, based on my research, the worse it gets, the more fractured people get, the more ideological people get. And so in that sense, I just think it makes it doubly important to try to bridge divides now while we still can.
Jonathan Metzl, professor and author of Dying of Whiteness, thank you once again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.